The Spinoff Podcast Network.
Talo for Lover. I'm Madeline Chapman, editor at The Spinoff. If you have the means, consider supporting our high-quality journalism by becoming a Spinoff member. Sign up now at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
You're listening to Business is Boring, a podcast that reckons it's anything but. Business is Boring is brought to you by Spark Lab, offering inspiration and practical advice to help businesses find their edge. To hear more about Spark Lab, including details about the latest events, workshops, and business tools, visit sparklab.co.nz. And now, here's your host, Simon Pound.
Kia ora koutou katoa. Welcome to Business is Boring. AI is the biggest topic in business right now. CEOs are saying that they're reducing headcount and increasing profit. Every day, it seems like there is a new science fiction plot made real. We have autonomous robot assistants, large language models passing bar exams, and text prompts making realistic videos and images. And it's just day one. How do we make sense of all this? Well, one local business out to do this is 10 Past Tomorrow, who offer talks, consulting, and CEO sessions to help business understand, engage, and benefit from AI. Mark Lawrence is the founder, and he joins us now to talk everything AI. Tēnā koe, thank you for being here.
Kia ora, Simon. Thanks for having me.
Hey, so first up, before you got interested in the world of AI, you were deep in the world of marketing, right? What were you up to there?
So I was in the marketing agency game, specifically in content marketing and running the strategy side of, even more specifically, HubSpot businesses. And so I've thought about this recently. If you trace the dots back from where I am now, that was the first exposure to like really powerful technology automation to like radically ramp up human efficiency and productivity. Obviously, back in those days, it was kind of traditional, classical automation. There was no AI involved, but I think that was kind of the genesis for me of how do we use technology to ramp up what we can do, but like crucially from a human-centric point of view, how do we do less of the drudge work? How do we do less of the menial stuff that kind of keeps us from the higher ticket part of our work, but also like crucially the stuff that's really engaging, really fulfilling, and from a financial point of view, the higher ticket work as well.
Yeah, that stuff and, you know, marketing automation and doing things at scale, those were the first things where, you know, very much like the birth of AI, was very rules-based and very much about automating regular processes with what comes next after something happening. And at scale, where you see that once you get enough volume, there are kind of normal responses, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so now what we have is those traditional automations and those rules-based automations, they're kind of being overhauled by this layer of intelligence which you can put on top of it. So you can still have that mass personalization, but that level of personalization that we can bring to, like, if we're specifically talking marketing and customer service, you can now have real one-to-one conversations, but en masse, and they are genuinely personalized communications, which is it's kind of new for the world of marketing, for the world of business, and for society at scale.
Yeah, a lot more personal than swapping out the first name
exactly.
And then not getting it right and sending out a email that says, hi, first name. And so did you kind of see the writing on the wall in the marketing world with AI? Or was it a surprise to you too? Because I remember, you know, living in the world, you know, marketing adjacent kind of world, we all thought that AI was going to take the conveyancing lawyers and things like that that were very rules-based and very repetitive first. But actually the first thing that AI seems to be removing jobs of are the content and copy people doing like content, right?
Yeah, it's fascinating. You know, like I'm a trained futurist, and for the past 10 years, all of the commentary in the futurism world was first jobs on the chopping block would be your manual, menial, you know, blue-collar work, and that would be overtaken by robots, and then we'd progress up the kind of intellectual chain to...
Creativity was sacrosanct.
Exactly.
Oh, there's nothing that, you know, creativity will never be taken down by AI, and yet it's the first thing.
Exactly, and that's what's been so fascinating to watch. Mm. And so, like, to answer your question, yeah, I did see some sparks of what was happening kind of 3 or 4 years ago in AI, and that's why I chose to go down that path. But anyone who sits there and tells you that they foresaw all of this coming in this time frame is probably a bit disingenuous. And like that's exemplified by even OpenAI when they released ChatGPT. Mm. Their objectives for it was they were hoping to have kind of 40,000 users within 6 months. So even they did not know what they were sitting on and what they were releasing. So it really has, it's blown us all away, yeah, including the people who made it.
And to, you know, finish that context, right, like they ended up with 1 million users in a couple of weeks or something, right? Like it was bananas.
Yeah, they were the fastest tech application to have 100 million users, you know. That was overtaken soon after by Threads, but they transitioned their users across from their Facebook pool. So, unbelievable the growth rate just in that one. Like ChatGPT is obviously only it's the tip of the iceberg with generative AI, but it's indicative of how quickly it's being embraced.
How did you then get into the space, like an evolving and emerging space? Like still today, right? Like it's still, you know, it's a cliche to say it's still day one, but I mean, there's only a very small number of the people in the world who are focusing, specializing, and really deep in this space now. But yeah, how did you get into it?
So I took myself out of the marketing agency game, and I went and, as I said, I trained as a futurist. And so that was predominantly through an organization in Silicon Valley called the Institute for the Future. And when I was in that world, that is when, you know, I started to see the sparks of what was happening kind of 3 years ago with the early GPT models, and there were kind of consumer products being built on top of them. They were terrible and very unusable at the time, but I just placed a few bets there that the pace of development, if you could extrapolate that, there was some huge stuff coming. Didn't quite know when. So it kind of went from digital marketing, futurism, and then within that world of futurism, then came the deep dive into AI and where I am now.
How do you train as a futurist at the Institute of the Future? That sounds really cool.
It's fascinating. Like I've spent my life kind of thinking about the future. Where are we going? You're like, you might remember Beyond 2000 back in the 80s.
Yeah, I remember when Beyond 2000 was the future.
It was a big thing, right? So that's how I naturally think. Futurism is a fascinating field of study. There's some really defined frameworks and methodologies that you can use to think about the future and how all of the different facets of society are converging. And you can put that within any given context or industry to kind of not predict the future, but to forecast some possibilities. They're called scenarios in futurism, scenarios of what the future may look like for any given industry or organization. And it really is. It's a fascinating way to be trained to think and to help other organizations to think in that way.
Yeah, wow. So you head into organizations and help them get a picture of what the future could look like, a number of scenarios for their industry or the things adjacent or influencing them.
Yeah, so the futurism side of things, those frameworks, they really just sit in the background for me. So 10 Past Tomorrow is specifically focused on generative AI and helping organizations understand it, contextualize it, develop AI literacy, train companies on how to use it, and then also offer strategic guidance to the senior leadership teams. But what I've found is that training in futurism is super, super useful to have as a framework for helping companies to think about, because it is such a futuristic technology by nature, right? So the two, the futurism and the AI, they really overlap and become kind of it's obviously a fuzzy, it's sometimes a fuzzy line between futurism and AI.
Yeah. And yeah, tell us about how you came to start 10 Past Tomorrow And yeah, you're saying there that you help these businesses with understanding it. But yeah, how do you actually go about like engaging with people?
Look, it's a really strong viewpoint of mine that it all starts with literacy, with AI literacy. So obviously I train companies on how to use the technology bespoke to their business model, because it's very different from company to company, industry to industry, and guide those senior leadership teams about what is coming next. How is your industry going to evolve? How would you like to internally disrupt yourselves based on this technology? Because if you don't, others will. But it all starts, I'm very firm on this, any engagements have to start with educating all of your people, you know, from your new grad student who joined 5 days ago through to your CEO. They all need to be educated to that foundational level of knowledge about AI. What is it? Why has generative AI burst onto the scene in the last 18 months? Where's it come from? Why is it so different? Why is it so powerful? What are the use cases within business? But also, like, really crucially, the education has to be, what are the concerns? What are the risks? What are the challenges of this technology as well? And I just feel that you can't progress to those tactical skills trainings and particularly to the strategic viewpoint of the technology unless everyone has that foundational literacy.
And how do you set that up for people? As even if you've been following the space pretty closely and, you know, are a big old nerd and interested in this stuff, like I've been, it still felt like the OpenAI, ChatGPT, you know, Perplexity, these things did explode in such a way of just absolutely lapping what people like Google had been talking about and slowly open sourcing and slowly building and slowly demonstrating over a 10-year period. And then, boom!
Here it is.
Someone just comes out running a completely different race.
Yeah. Look, I'm not going to step over in that question. You did inadvertently call me a big old nerd.
No. I'm a big old nerd, yeah.
But yeah, look, the first part of that is actually, it's fascinating as to how this technology is being reshaped simply on who was first to market with it, you know. So all of these tech companies, they've been sitting on this type of technology for a few years. OpenAI dropped it on top of everyone because they essentially had nothing to lose, you know. Google weren't going to release it because it's cannibalizing their own business. So OpenAI, run by Sam Altman, who is he's an entrepreneur at heart. He's released this technology, which is, it's the most powerful technology we've ever had. He's released it at $20 a month for the world to use.
And free if you're not doing anything that's too, you know, built into your operations.
Exactly. Whereas I kind of think if this was IBM, who were the leader in the space kind of 10, 15 years ago, if they had released this technology, would they have released it at free or $20 a month? Absolutely not. And so, you know, it's fascinating to think why we now have these mass consumer models and this rapid adoption. It's because of the personalities behind it, you know.
That's super, just to jump into that Google thing there, that's super interesting. And yeah, IBM made the early running, absolutely. But Google have been making most of the running in the 10 years leading up to this moment, in the you know open source community, right? And they've had this technology, yet still, if I make a Google Calendar appointment, and you know this is an example that everyone listening will understand, and I go, hey, it's at my it's in this meeting room.
Mm-hmm.
It should know by now that if it's in a meeting room, that it's at my work. Yet if I go to put location in, I still have to like write in that it's at my work.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd think if you were Google, you know, and you'd been making the running, you'd be able to do a few more things to be a bit smarter. The fact they've kept all of their, and that's, you know, just one of a bazillion examples of ways that they could be using this, you know, this kind of technology that mm-hmm. they have sitting there mm-hmm. to make the product experience better. But they just kind of haven't. Like, it's wonderful, like amazing to look at how dumb they've left their products when they have so much smarts.
Yeah. Again, you've got to look at the business model there. You know, so that you're right. They invented this technology, the transformer technology that all of these large language models are built upon. Why didn't they release it? Because they had, you know, for the last few decades, they've had the greatest business model on the planet. And this technology is now disrupting and cannibalizing that business model. So you can see why they didn't release it. They have definitely been caught asleep at the wheel. And they are lagging now behind OpenAI and Microsoft and even a couple of other players like Anthropic.
Mm.
Do not count them out. You know, they have the winners in this space are going to be the companies that have the biggest amount of computing power, the most access to data, and then the best, obviously, AI talent and engineers. They have arguably all of those three things. And so they've done in the background, they've consolidated their AI talent and they've put together two of their AI labs who are now much more consumer focused rather than research focused. They have some of the biggest computing power in the world. They also have the most data in the world. So
yeah, and real life data, right? Like the kind of useful data where it knows how people get to and from places with maps.
Mm-hmm.
They know how people want to source information through search.
Mm-hmm.
They know how people communicate and what people are up to next in their diary.
Exactly.
Like they should be a lot
they will
smarter.
Be. Yes. Yeah, they will be. They're already catching up. They're making a few faux pas along the way, but don't discount them. They're definitely, if not the leader in a couple of years, they will be one of them.
Yeah, and super interesting because data is the new, oil or gold or whatever those kind of cliches are, right? But in the case of Google, they don't have to go to other partners like some of these other AI companies are making partnerships with.
That's right.
Reddit and other sources of, you know, user-generated knowledge.
Yep.
They have Gmail, and that's got 1.6 billion users or something, bananas.
YouTube as well.
YouTube.
You know, it's just a treasure trove of data, both visually, obviously, and being able to make sense of real-world models, like you're seeing products like Sora start to come out. So YouTube, and for a physical understanding of the world, is going to be incredibly valuable to them. But then, obviously, they transcribe all of those videos as well. And so the mountains of textual data that comes out of that also puts them at a huge advantage.
And YouTube's like the second biggest search engine in the world, right? Although I imagine TikTok's coming for it.
Yeah. And look, like I want to stay on topic for you, but there's so many rabbit holes here that within that data conversation, there's also a big conversation at the moment right now of like, when do these models run out of actual human data to train on? And so one of the big fields that they're going into at the moment is training on synthesized data where, you know, AI creates its own data to train itself, like Inception. And so that is most likely going to be the future. And so those kind of partnerships that OpenAI and others are going into with Reddit and the New York Times, etc., they may or may not be short-lived things.
Wow. And so how do you categorize, going back to that kind of, you know, the first thing you're doing to help people understand AI, how do you characterize where we are today in the journey? Because that day one cliche, it feels kind of like for me, and you know, I've talked about it a bit lately, but we're at once in day one in that, you know, it's still the very start of the integration of these technologies into business in the same way that, you know, internet or the cloud was day one for a number of years.
Yep. Yep.
But also we're 2 years behind the technology and what we're playing with, in that, you know, the really, really breathtaking advances of the GPT models, they were actually technologically there a couple of years ago.
Mm.
And then they've been safety training and, you know, creating ways for people to interact with them better. So I kind of feel like, you know, any day we could be dropped another 2 years of the future on a faster timeline. Like it feels like things are going to get very fast paced and very weird over the next couple of years to me.
To answer the first part of your question first, where are we? Maybe a useful metaphor is to say, for those who can remember when Netscape came out, that was kind of that first browser experience. that's where we are with AI right now. You know, so Netscape, if you look back on it was super archaic. The user experience was terrible. There was like very limited utility in what you could do with it. That's where we are with AI right now. Although obviously the technology is built on the shoulders of, you know, 30 years of internet, plus the cloud revolution, mobile, et cetera, et cetera. So as powerful as these models are right now, and they truly are, we're only in that Netscape moment, you know. So this is, it's a phrase that's used quite often, this is the dumbest AI that we will ever have from this point onwards, you know. And then in terms of that pace of change of what you're talking about, we could wake up tomorrow and we're 2 years down the track. That's absolutely right. And again, you've got to come back to, it's interesting to look at the personalities of the people who are releasing this technology. And so Sam Altman, to go back to him again, at OpenAI, he has this kind of, he hasn't talked about it, but when you watch how he behaves, it's his belief that we are not far away from AGI, right? And he knows how...
Oh, and sorry, AGI, please explain that for us.
AGI meaning artificial general intelligence, which is essentially, there's varying descriptions for it. It's essentially an AI who can do everything that humans can do at a far greater level of intelligence and pace and power. So he believes we're only a few years away from that. And it's kind of his prerogative that we need to release this technology in increments. You can't just drop that technology on the world and expect us to adapt. So they've got the power to release things that are much more powerful. They're choosing not to. They're choosing to release it step by step so that we can at least try and acclimatize and keep pace.
And it's still hard to wrap your head around the stuff. And there's a conscious throttling of the release of the power of this technology, and it's quite wild, right?
Yep, it is. It is. I spend every day kind of walking this tightrope between the fascination and being enthralled by the technology, and also being like really kind of often quite scared about the implications of where the technology is going as well.
I think that's a really important topic to pick up on, and maybe let's stop for a minute and come back and talk about, yeah, where that technology is coming, the good side and the potential negative side, and also some practical stuff about how business can and larger business can start incorporating this from day one. Because like, if you're not using OpenAI or Perplexity or one of these models as your kind of Google assistant for searching now, you're really missing out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Love it. We'll be back in a moment. Spark is proud to partner with the Sustainable Business Network and the Climate Action Toolbox. The free Climate Action Toolbox can provide you with simple step-by-step guides to measure and reduce your emissions. Help lead the way to a low-carbon future for New Zealand. Visit sparklab.co.nz/sustainability to find out more.
Ready to rediscover the joys of cycling? With over 300 kilometres of cycle paths across Tāmaki Makaurau, jumping on your bike and going for a ride is such a fun way to discover the city from a different perspective. Cycling is getting more and more popular across Auckland, so now's a great time to join the hype and give cycling a go. Head to at.govt/cycling to find your nearest cycleway today.
Hoki mai anō, welcome back to Business is Boring, where we're with Mark Lawrence of 10 Past Tomorrow. So yeah, as you just mentioned there's a lot of kind of sensationalism in the media where people are like, this is going to wipe out a bazillion jobs and AI is going to prey on people and, you know, it's going to be like Terminator 2 and stuff. And then there's also a lot of, you know, everything's great and just look at all this cool tech utopianism and robots will be doing all our jobs kind of like stuff. And somewhere in the middle is the truth, right? But like, when you've got something that's got such a pace of change, what are the things that you think we need to consider and be thinking about in terms of, yeah, safety, accessibility, making it good for people?
The first thing I think is there's a lot of myths that are developing out there, and that's why you've kind of got that disparity in that wide spectrum of thought about AI. What I've noticed is when I give kind of public talks, about 80, 90% of people in the room have used a free version of AI. They've used free ChatGPT, for mm-hmm. example, and that's their full experience with AI. The difference between a free version of these tools and then the paid version, it's the equivalent of having like a 12-year-old human assistant using the free version of these tools versus if you use the paid versions, the power of them, it's really like having a collection of PhD level intellect behind you. So there's a real disparity between the power of these tools. And that's why you get these myths of like, oh, you know, I've tried it. It was really generic. It can't be creative. It writes like an American. It can't write like me. It can't really do what I do. And so the first point that I try and make is just dispelling those myths. And through practical, useful demonstrations of exactly how these things, how powerful they are, right? And then I think the second part of that conversation is how do we deploy this technology safely, ethically, morally? There's a fascinating study which I talk about regularly, which is about this time last year, Harvard Business School got together with Boston Consulting Group and they took 758 Boston Consulting Group consultants. They put them through 18 tasks, which were designed to be exactly like they do in their real life. They divided those 758 consultants into three groups. The first group had no access to AI. Second group had the paid version of GPT, ChatGPT. And the third group had the paid version plus 5 hours of training. The results were pretty remarkable. Those two groups who had the AI assistants, in the time they had available, they did 12% more tasks. They did each of those tasks 25% faster. And because they're objectively measured tasks, they did them 40% better. So the implications there are if just using this technology can give everybody a 25% jump at least in efficiency and do things 40% better, what do we do with those gains in efficiency? And this is really kind of one of the crunch themes that I help clients navigate. And so to get back to your question, the safe deployment of this technology, the ethical deployment, and the moral deployment of this technology, there's a variety of ways that leaders can choose to deploy those gains, right? There will be leadership who are quite cutthroat and say, well, if you can do things 30% better, 40% better, 30, 40% faster, that means I only need 50% of you, right? I think that will happen, and that we're even seeing it happen, right? Whereas my hope and kind of the whole intent of 10 Past Tomorrow is how do we use those gains and level up? How do we level up as individuals and companies, but also kind of as society? If we're released from all that drudge work and that menial stuff, that gives us a chance to do more of what we love, more of what's really meaningful for our clients and our customers. But also we have the chance to be aspirational and to do things which we've never been able to do, but we now have the technology that's there. So I think the outputs are homogenous. Everyone has the same access to these outputs, but it's how we choose to use them as leaders that will kind of define this technology, I think.
That point about the training's really interesting because, yeah, there are, as you say, these myths, these kind of memes almost about, oh, you know, like it's this. And it's like, well, it's all about the prompts you put in. So if you keep prompting and keep changing and keep, you know, working towards it, you can get there. And so that idea of training, and this is just, you know, in the GPT kind of thing, but I guess in the same principles carry through to how you create new automations or how you stop doing, dumb things in your business. Like, you know, like how you train and how you implement and how you, how you kind of interact with it is what's going to be the differentiator for people, right? Like just giving people the internet doesn't make them better at their jobs.
No, that's 100% correct. And then also, kind of counterintuitively, it's also not correct depending on the scenario. So for a lot of use cases, for quick and dirty use cases, these tools are so powerful and intuitive that they know and they can guide you towards towards what you want just simply by interacting with them, almost as the way you'd talk to an intern or to an assistant. Then the training comes in once you start to have slightly more complex use cases. That's when the prompting, the prompt engineering and the prompt training really starts to come into play, and where you really start to go to level up those outputs and the jump in efficiency and productivity.
What are those, like, right now, day one, super easy, everyone should be doing things, you know, like buy a paid version of a GPT and start using it in X way? Like, what should people be doing?
Yep, 100%. That is first cab off the rank, really. Pay the $20 a month for a premium version of either ChatGPT, Google Gemini, Claude, Opus. It's the best business and personal investment you'll ever make. You mentioned Perplexity. So I don't think I've used Google probably in the last 4 or 5 months. I've made the jump across to Perplexity, which is essentially, if you imagine an AI version of Google, it's an answer machine rather than a search machine. So I'd recommend those two as really quick and easy implementations. If you want to get a sense of kind of how human-like these tools are becoming, I'd recommend, it's a free app, it's called Pi, P-I. That's been created to be a really almost like a human conversation interface where you can have conversations on absolutely anything. And even for me, knowing what I know about AI, within 2 or 3 minutes of conversing with this thing, I'm still fooled into thinking it is a human. So I'd recommend that as a good early touch point as well.
Yeah, cool. And then the thing, love that. And I was chatting with Simon Robertson, who's a mutual friend on this podcast the other day, and just talked about, you know, the difference between if you Google to get a maths problem, it shows you a calculator. If you Google with one of these answering machines with a maths problem, it shows you the working and gives you the answer. And, you know, there are examples of it not working, and you do have to check your working. And, you know, don't just run thinking that everything you get out of one of these things is 100% true straight away. But if you can check the working and it is true, it's a hell of a lot more helpful than just showing you a calculator. And that's the difference that we're looking at now, right? And in the world of, you know, there's a lot of talk as well about, you know, some industries, like if you're in film production and your job is to make background scenes, you know, you look at something like Sora, and with just a text prompt, you can get a very rich video made. And that's just day one as well. It feels like the non-vital parts of storytelling, film, imagery are going to be, all the background stuff's going to be AI before we know it, and then who knows how long it takes before the central stuff becomes AI too.
Yep. And so I go back to, we get agency over those decisions, you know. And so I think, to be realistic, absolutely there's going to be job displacement come from this technology, and it's going to come at a rate that we have not had before. You know, like, we've had the Industrial Revolution, for example, which took kind of 100 years to go from being an agriculture-based economy to being industrial. This is going to happen much faster in the space of kind of one generation. And so I'm going to be realistic and say there's going to be some short-term pain. As humans, we will adapt and we will evolve, and there will be whole new jobs, industries that are created that we don't have right now. And so we will adapt. In the short term, during that pain, I just go back to what I said about, it's up to us to choose how we evolve with this technology. So in the film industry, for example, yes, the technology is there, that it could really, and it's going to tip that whole industry on its head. But there will be leaders within that get to choose, okay, if this particular role is displaced by AI, what do we do with those people? Like, how can we, again, like, level up and be aspirational? Can we retrain those people? Can we redeploy them on other tasks and kind of human-centric tasks within the industry and within the process? And I think that you can copy and paste that into any industry, in any department of any business.
And if you're at the front, you use it as your co-pilot to supercharge your creative skills. So, you know, in our business, design, branding, you know, positioning and stuff, like, if we want to mock up a concept for imagery. Mm-hmm. We just do it in Midjourney now. And then we'll still go and do our own version because that's the dream. You want to make something that's special and real. But as it gets better, that last step will fall out, you know? And like the people who are, you know, your ability to make new things has never been easier. But yeah, very, very challenging if your whole business model is the fact no one can make things.
Yeah, look, I'll give you a real tangible example of, so there's augmentation. How do you, as you're saying, how do you use it as a co-pilot? It's a very powerful way to use the technology. There's also automation, which is you hand a whole process over to the technology and it takes it off your hands. So I built for a client a tool whereby they're a branding agency, a marketing branding agency. Any agency, when they onboard a new client, has a significant period of time where they're basically repeating a template and onboarding a client with a pile of documents that they produce for every client. This particular client, that takes about 6 weeks for them to onboard their new clients. We built a tool which, in the space of about a minute, so the new client coming on board fills out a form all about their business, and that then goes into a back-end automation which automates that manual process that the agency goes through to create vision statements, mission statements, customer demographic profiling, brand, typography, colors, et cetera, et cetera. 6 weeks of work is done in about 45 seconds for them. It puts out a 35-page document, which they then spend 3 days refining, adding to, checking. But it allows them to, as I've kind of hinted at a couple of times, they don't love that 6 weeks of work. It's kind of repetitive, it's menial, and it stops them from delivering real value for the client, puts it 6 weeks down the track. They can now do that in, well, a minute or 3 days. And so that, I think, is the power of how we're going to see this technology changing companies and changing roles.
That's so interesting. Any process you can automate and then edit, which I think anyone who, you know, it's very easy to edit something to make it better. It's very hard to start with a blank piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
And if nothing else, you know, a series of good prompts to get something that's within Kui gets you very far on the journey, right?
Exactly.
And like I said, this is day one. You know, as it learns more what the regular uses are for people who look like, you know, your work or your approach, the initial templates that are put in front of you will just get richer and richer until they're better than what most people can do.
There was a interview released by, well, it was with Sam Altman about 10 days ago, and it was a marketing-focused interview. And the question was, within 3 years, what's the marketing world going to look like? And his response was, 95% of work that is done by marketing agencies and professionals right now will be done by an AI. They'll be able to conceptualize, strategize, plan, and build complex campaigns, including text, video, photos, market research, etc. So, you know, if that is our future within 3 years, as you're saying, this stuff is only advancing at a really rapid pace. That is the stuff that I spend my time thinking about. What does, and you can extrapolate that out. That's not just the marketing industry. That's any industry. And so that is my mission, is to, how do we, as New Zealand companies, New Zealand leaders, and then kind of wider society, how are we going to evolve with this pace of change?
There's also a truism in these conversations where everything we're saying in this podcast is either going to look laughably naive in a few years because it will all seem so obvious and self-evident, or it's going to look silly because we were, you know, off the mark for some other reason, right? And so it's very dangerous to talk about the future as a rule. But I mean, I've been through quite a few hype cycles of things. I got excited about the cloud and left advertising and jumped into cloud software because I thought it was going to be as big as the internet. And, you know, that was really cool. And, you know, crypto came along and I thought, this feels like, you know, it's going to be a huge change, but I don't know. I really don't know about throwing my whole life behind NFTs or anything. And so kind of stayed out of some of the frothiness there.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of Web3 ideas are cool, but like maybe more idea than immediate execution. But then I look at this and I go, well, the idea is massive. The immediate execution is massive. The tangible benefits are massive. This feels bigger than what I can understand about it, is my kind of instinct on it, right? And from your you know, going really deep in this world, what's your gut feeling?
I think it's absolutely right to be cautious. I try to be as well. I really don't like being sensationalist, and I kind of shy away from that aspect of futurism and AI. However, I think we only need to look at the pace of change of this technology over the last kind of 5 or 10 years since generative AI has really been in our world, that you can see that it is real and it is developing. I don't even say it's developing at an exponential rate. It's developing at a step change rate, you know. So my gut feeling is, even if we take that particular Sam Altman quote of 95% of what a marketing agency does right now will be done by an AI in 3 years, let's remove that 95%. It may or may not be that. But directionally, I think that those type of predictions are correct, and we would be silly to focus on the 95%, but that type of change, it's my gut feeling that that's coming.
Every industry is going to have a newspapers to the internet moment, and that's kind of what we're looking at. Like, what we don't know exactly what it's going to. There's still newspapers that exist, but everything's changed. Mm-hmm. And like, that's what we're looking at, right? Like, you know, everything's going to go through that cycle of change.
Yep, that's correct. And I think I feel like a really big responsibility to couch all of these conversations in positivity and inspiration, rather than negativity and fear. I think there's a lot of that out there and a lot of kind of negative sensationalism around it. I prefer to focus on, like, yes, there are absolutely risks and challenges around, but I just go back to, we have agency over these decisions to a large extent.
And we've talked a lot about media and things that are close and design and things that are close and, the things I work in. But the things that I don't understand are the places that I'm most excited about. The way that AI is finding new ways to identify interactions between drugs and cancer, the way that AI is finding ways to work out ways that decarbonisation can become more cost effective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these things that are in spaces that are like really exciting, which are way out of my area of work and understanding. You read a little bit of those things and you're like, far out, there's a lot to be excited about in the future of this and in some of these big problems facing our society. At the same time as we go, we're probably heading into a period of it being very hard to understand what's real when we see or interact with something online, and that's going to get fucking weird, like real weird. And you're already getting these cases of fraud happening with spoofed videos of people and getting people to send money around. Yeah, bananas, right? Like, that's going to get more and more. We're going to have to go back to doing business in person to believe anything for a while. You know, we're going into a period of huge job and societal change, but also a period of huge, like, potential unlock maybe we just don't know, but it feels like that's the way the threads are going, right?
No, we absolutely don't know. And like, I love this thread of conversation. You know, we can talk till we're blue in the face about how do we raise productivity, how do we raise efficiency, you know, and that's right here, right now. You know, businesses are raising productivity and efficiency by kind of 40, 50, 60%.
Which is wild. Like, there's never been anything like that.
Unbelievably. It's fantastic, right? And then you have, in the same breath, a month ago, there's a medical research lab that is using this technology. They came up with, in about 3 months of project work, they have theorized 1,800 new compounds, new substances, you know, which... That is wild. That's 40 years of traditional science compacted into 3 months. And so there you have the possibility of, do we need our world to be so dominated by concrete, you know, or is within that 1,800 new compounds, is there a possible solution to that? There's There's massive advances happening, as you said, in the medical field, and so there are solutions to medical and health problems that have plagued us as humans, which was probably right around the corner, you know. So it's unbelievably energizing and motivating.
And about the only thing we can predict is that there's going to be a whole lot of things coming down the line that change our shape of what the world means. And, you know, the first time people played with GPT is one of them. The first time you see those humanoid robots doing things is another one. You know, like it's moving. As a final thought, like, you know, how would you encourage people to, you know, stay involved and not get overwhelmed and not disconnect? Like, what are the best ways to engage in the space without falling down those, without getting overwhelmed?
Mm. Yeah. There's a couple of ways to answer that. As individuals, like, we obviously live in a world where we can access information on any given topic. I read about 8 to 10 AI-focused newsletters every morning. I listen to 5 or 6 AI podcasts every week. If you, just to put a name out there, there's a newsletter which is very, very intuitive, easy to understand, called Ben's Bytes. Mm. Ben as in Benjamin. That's a great place. It's a daily newsletter, breaks down everything that's happening, but in really easy, intuitive ways to understand. So I encourage everybody just to try really easy ways like that to stay up with what's happening in AI. And then for companies, something that I encourage every company to implement at the moment is something called an AI council, which is collect 6 to 8 people within your company who have a real personal passion for AI. Collect them from all strata of your company, you know, right from your intern through to your senior leadership team. These people will be keeping pace with AI just because they're fascinated by it themselves, you know. Put together a company breakfast, shout them a company breakfast every fortnight where they can get together, they can compare ideas of, hey, did you see this happen? Did you see this happen? I think that could really help us in this way. What do you think? What have you seen happening? It's a really easy but powerful way for companies and organizations to kind of generate AI literacy from within. So I'd recommend, from a personal point of view and a company point of view, those are two really easy touch points to get involved.
Yeah, and if it feels like things are moving fast and it's already getting away from you, it's not. It's day one. Like, you know, exactly. It's like we're at the Netscape. That's a lovely, lovely way of looking at it. You know, like we're before Windows, guys.
Yeah, please just like don't be intimidated by the technology. I think there are a lot of people and organizations out there who it's in their best interest to kind of mystify it and sensationalize it and to make it seem really complex and hard to engage with. The awesome thing about this technology is it's actually so smart that it's really, really intuitive and works with us. So, yeah, I go back to that. Pay for a version of ChatGPT, get involved, because this is day one. We're still very early movers, I don't think there's a more important technology that we all need to be keeping pace with.
Yeah, I spend quite a bit of my days, arguing is a bit of a word, but trying to positively encourage ChatGPT to be more what I'm after. Like it's huge. Hey, thank you so much for joining us. The last thought would be, what will success be for you in, because you've got kind of, you know, a consultancy side, but also an advocacy and education side to what you're up to. What will success be for you and for 10 Past Tomorrow?
I heard one of your recent interviews, and the answer to this was we already feel successful. From a business point of view, 10 Past Tomorrow is successful. But from a personal point of view, it would be that as many New Zealanders as possible are raising their level of AI literacy, you know, and that's both on becoming aware of the amazing power of it, but also the flip side of that coin of the challenges and the concerns. And I think how do you measure that? If I start to see really like balanced conversations happening around dinner parties rather than kind of the myth-based conversations that are happening at the moment, that would be success. The other success, this is maybe getting super philosophical, but that interview I just referenced was with your Unyoked interview, and those guys are all about, you know, how do we disconnect from technology and become more immersed in nature. I've got this dichotomy of I really believe in that as well as being fascinated by AI. So for me, what would success look like? It would mean if when my children are growing up, that I notice that they're taking all the benefits of this technology and it's really improving their lives. And at the same time, somehow we've managed to retain that balance that they want to jump in the ocean with me and go surfing. They want to come hiking. They want to go camping. And that would mean to me that as a society, we've managed to like implement this technology in a balanced way that's best for us and minimizing the risks and concerns.
Yeah, love it. Well, so great to chat. Thank you for coming and sharing your story and experience with us today. Can't wait to see where we all go next. That's Mark Lawrence of 10 Past Tomorrow.
Thanks, Simon.
Thank you so much to Mark. Yeah, check out, he has a newsletter as well that he very modestly didn't mention, but if you head to 10 Past Tomorrow, you can get amongst that as well. Thank you to everyone who listens and helps bring this together, like our producer, Teaihei Butler. If you like what we do, please do rate and leave a review. E no hora.
From the Spin-Off Podcast Network, that was Business is Boring, brought to you by SparkLab. Make sure you're following Business is Boring wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information on SparkLab, visit sparklab.co.nz.
Kia ora e te iwi, Teaihei Butler here, podcast manager at The Spin-Off. If you enjoy listening to our podcasts, consider supporting our mahi by signing up to become a Spin-Off member at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
The Spin-Off Podcast Network.